We looked at Hinduism last class, and we're going to do Buddhism this class. First, we want to read 10 verses. Exodus 32. The golden calf. Now, when the people saw that Moses delayed to come down from the mountain, the people assembled around Aaron and said to him, "Come, make us a God who will go before us. As for this Moses, the man who brought us up from the land of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him." And Aaron said to them, "Tear off the gold rings which are in the ears of your wives, your sons, and your daughters, and bring them to me." Then all the people tore off the gold rings which were in their ears and brought them to Aaron. And he took this from their hand and fashioned it with a graving tool and made it into a molten calf. And they said, "This is your God, O Israel, who brought you up from the land of Egypt." Now when Aaron saw this, he built an altar before it. And Aaron made a proclamation and said, "Tomorrow shall be a feast to this Lord." So the next day they rose early and offered burnt offerings and brought peace offerings. And the people sat down to eat and to drink and rose up to play. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, "Go down at once, for your people whom you brought up from the land of Egypt have corrupted themselves. They have quickly turned aside from the way which I commanded them. They have made for themselves a molten calf and have worshipped it and have sacrificed to it and said, 'This is your God, O Israel, who brought you up from the land of Egypt.'" Verse 9. And the Lord said to Moses, "I have seen these people, and behold, they are an obstinate people. Now then, let me alone, that my anger may burn against them, and that I may destroy them, and I will make of you a great nation. Your God of the Bible, hates idols. When you substitute for him something else and give it the acclamation and give it the honor and give it the worship that only deserves by your God, your God recognizes what's going on with people. Your God comments on what people do. Your God directly instructs people how to think, what the value. And your God is a personal God. Here's a God that knows you individually, knows what you do, and when you disobey and when you obey. He's a loving God. We've talked about that. A God that has all the mercy in the world. And how did he prove that he loves you? He sent his only begotten Son to sacrifice for you individually. That's the kind of God that you worship. That battle of idols was fought in the New Testament. We just had it in the Acts class. Acts 17. 16, 17 in there. That Paul, the apostle, had to still fight idols. Had to still fight the minds of people that were trying to put their trust and their future in objects made of metal, made of clay, made of the things of this earth. They're just idols. And he suffered for that, but he also made his points. He argued, he talked, he reasoned, sometimes to no avail, sometimes to avail. But he did the right thing in reasoning with individuals, God's creation, against these idols that would take the place and usurp the power of the only true and living God. Now, in our studies, we did Hinduism last time, and the millions of gods they have. But tonight we're looking at Buddhism. Quite a contrast in these two. Quite a contrast. But still a world religion with hundreds of millions of followers. Again, concentrated in more or less in the eastern, Middle Eastern area, the Far East. Now, I want to do a little comparison with Hinduism and Buddhism. Where are they similar? Where they're not? And it's always good to compare from time to time. And they have similar concepts. They both deal with rebirth. We know what that is. Rebirth and rebirth and reincarnation. And they adopt that in Hinduism and Buddhism. They deal with karma, the cause and effect. I think we explained that, maybe you all already know that there's in your life, you don't have a personal God that you deal with. You deal with karma. Karma is you do good acts and bad acts, acceptable acts and non-acceptable acts. And it's a little scorecard. And that's how you finally reach a period of nirvana in one's life. And then you can leave this life. And the last is dharma, and that's a moral order. And we'll talk some tonight about a moral order in the caste system. And we can get that in our minds. Now, reincarnation. I know when we talk Hindu, it's called Nastya. And in Buddhist, Nirvana. So those are all these words. Some of them you can't even pronounce. Not that you've been doing your reading, that's exactly right. But at least there's a terminology next to it and what they mean. And now, some people in this life say, I've been reincarnated. Well, what's your proof? Well, it's all subjective. I say, it happened to me. There's no proof. And a lot of them say, I had feelings of deja vu. I think we've all heard that word, deja vu. And so that's a proof on reincarnation. I'm from another time, another body. And some of them have recurring dreams. Well, they say that's proof. Well, no. But it's still proof that they give that's subjective. And the feelings that one has an old self, an old soul. Well, is that proof? It's all subjective. Okay. They have irrational phobias, whatever that is. All right. But it's certainly habits you may have that I didn't. Where'd that come from? Okay. Where'd I get those words? Maybe my other life. So they use that as proof. And these days, the justifying of trans men and women. Well, I was a man or a woman in my past life. And that's why I act the way I do this way, this in this life. Interesting. Okay. Very interesting as a justification for disrupting sports and whatever it is. All right. And seeing. So it's a thing that they offer proofs for, and I want to make you aware of those in case you hear that someday about this idea of reincarnation. Some of them feel that they've had a kinship with other cultures. I kind of like that. Somehow back in my mind, I can feel the vibrations. I can feel the oneness, that sort of thing. So it's interesting. And sometimes they got periods of time that they're familiar with, but they don't know how they're familiar with it. So I just wanted to make you aware that people have those proofs, quote unquote, okay, that I've been reincarnated or something is proof. So be aware of that if you hear that. Of course, that's all subjective. Sometimes you can read things or you hear things on TV or radio or from other people, and somehow it just kind of gets into your consciousness. So be aware of that when you deal with reincarnation. Now, karma is interesting because, it has life and it has ups and downs. It has pluses and minuses of good works and bad works. And it's interesting when you compare Hinduism and Buddhism. Hinduism, we know, has many gods. But Hinduism is something other that's really, really strange. that, in matter of fact, Buddhism rejects, Hinduism is a caste system. Everybody know, maybe heard of a caste system? Okay? And in their caste system, it was, of course, they officially outlawed it in 1950, but all the centuries before that, the millennia before that, it was in effect. And in your material, it divides people into four rigid groups based solely on heredity. Who was your mother and father? Okay, what family you're of. And members of each caste system are restricted to their occupation and their association with other castes. This is the group I'm with. And how do you know what group? Well, they've got their most important book in Hindu law. It's called a Manus Smritireti. And it dates back 3,000 years. So this caste system has been going on for 3,000 years. And it's hard, caste system, on the people who are under it. And basically, it's where there's four groups, and there's a fifth group I'll talk about in just a second, where in your reincarnation, you come back as a certain group. And as your karma is higher, and from your last life, then you're elevated to a higher caste. Interesting. And it's been going on a long, long time. So you can see how people who are in who they marry, who they associate with, you're with that caste. And now, let me just oppose it to this country. This country, if you're poor, you come across with nothing in your pockets but $10, and you come into this country. This country allows you and promotes you that you can progress. It's your effort. You don't have to stay poor all your life. You don't have to be dumb all your life. You can progress. But in Indian culture, it's not that way. Even though they outlawed it in 1950, it's still there. And in the first one was the Brahmins. That'd be your teachers and intellectuals. Now, I mentioned before, I worked with one in this class, engineer, educated, from India. And, you know, it's one step out of nirvana. So, Brahmas, teachers and intellectuals, the Kasheris, the warriors and rulers, the Vishwasis, the traders and merchants, and the Shudras, laborers and menial workers. So you're in those classes. That's who you marry. That's who you stay with. That's the neighborhood you're in. That's the kind of education you get. And there's another one, a fifth class, that's really called the caste of the impure, the untouchables. And they're a secluded caste and expected to accept poverty and degradation as a fact of life. You just accept that because you're the fifth class. That's it. That's who you marry. That's where you live. That's what you do. And a majority of these Dalit children are chronically malnourished. And only 2 to 3% of these Dalit women can read or write. Dalit children who attend school are segregated from their classmates and are often assigned disagreeable jobs, such as doing toilet work and hard, smelly work, bad work. In the nation already steeped in poverty, the ancient customs of Hinduism prevent the Dalits, which is the name of this group, from rising above their extreme suffering and want. That's what you're born into. And that caste system exists today. And if I can say the first Buddha, that's Hinduism, the first Buddha said none of that. None of that. All people are equal. There is no caste system. And I just wanted to, maybe I mentioned to a couple of you, but is that a big deal in this country or anywhere else? Well, February 21st, so this is February 21st of this year up in Seattle. The city council on Tuesday added cast to the city's anti-discrimination laws, becoming the first U.S. city to ban caste discrimination and the first in the world to pass such a law outside of South Asia. Calls to outlaw discrimination based on caste, a division of people based on birth and descent, have grown louder among South Asian communities in the United States, but the movement has been getting pushed back from some Hindu Americans who argue that such legislation maligns a specific community. And it goes on and on. And tensions within the community were visible at Seattle City Council on Tuesday as a noisy hearing culminated with a 6-1 vote with a majority of the council members that caste discrimination crossed national and religious boundaries, and that without such laws, those facing caste discrimination in the United States will have no protections. So, is it one of them old issues? No, that's an issue right here, you know, in February. And so there's protections for that now. And you can see there was pushback from the Hindu community. Pushback, okay? Because that's our religion. That's why we separate people. That's why we hold people back. So things may be old when we talk about religions, okay, and people's ideas, but they're new and they're effective and they're alive today. And what I was reading, that in these castes, especially that one, how do you escape it? Well, I was born in it. My kids are going to be born in it. I've got a long way to go before I reach nirvana. Long way to go. What they do, they're susceptible to your words about the Christ. Because that moves them out of that, doesn't it? Leave that religion. So there's an avenue in case you run across different caste systems. Okay? Again, I was in the upper caste, the people I knew. But there's still an opportunity there to deal with them and talk to them reasonably, with reason, about the Christ of the Bible, the validity of the Scripture. And you can show your love and care for them, and then consequently love and care of Christ for them. So it's an avenue there in case you run across that. So I wanted to make that point about that. And the only reason I brought that up is because that's one of the standards that they use to judge whether you're going to reach nirvana. Okay. All right. Yes, ma'am. First of all, with calmness and directness. And that's exactly why I went through section 4. It took so long in section 4. Is because if you gave a faith in those words that we have, that book that we have, faith that it does historically correct, then it does more than just tell you about, like we'll see in Buddhism and Hinduism, the Bible that you have is historical. It runs you through history. And what you'll find in their writings, okay, are items of self-help. You'll find things of no real history at all. It's just things of how to live life. Deal with your emotions. Deal with interactions. And a lot of it is dealing with rituals, customs, festivals, that sort of thing. Doesn't really deal with historical documents like you have. So that's what I'd say. All right? And that and historical proof is really, really good. Okay? Again, not many people question the Old Testament, but to question the New Testament has so much data involved. Yes, sir. That's right.
Putting yourself in touch with God. And that was a very popular thing. And many of the, like you said, many of the things are just like rituals and things to probably get them in tune with that. But a lot of the other stuff is just oral tradition handed down. It's not one of the things.
That's exactly right. And that's one reason why I wanted to read that verse back in Exodus 32. Quite historical. And it shows that God was involved with those people personally, not just some ethereal force out there. But I care about you. I'm angry with you. Because you know who brought you through the Red Sea. You know who brought you out of Egypt. You know that the plagues, that's physical things, historical things. And like Alex has said, and you can read, the history of those times are there. And I would guess with Muslims, they knew that. But you can see how they kind of mixed and mingled in a lot of the Old Testament. You read through that and New Testament. After all, they're 600 years after Christ. So they have, we're going to say, plenty of time to mix and mingle the Old Testament and the New Testament. Now, similar. The Hindus and Buddhas, they both practice meditation, getting in touch with your inner self, deal with your emotions, deal with how to approach issues in your life, how to calm your spirit. They both have mantras where they say things over and over and over. That tends to condition one, doesn't it? Okay. So it's a psychological idea that they use. And meditation is part of all that. We see them, you know, Buddha's cross-legged. Okay, when they sit. When you see the statues that they have of Buddha. And even when you go into meditation, a yogi and all that sort of thing. All right, they want you to be cross-legged because that's the point of meditation. And we'll deal with that, the idea of what you think about while you're meditating. Or don't think about. Now, Hinduism and Buddhism, again, Buddhism is our topic tonight, but they have different gods. Oh, is that right? Yeah, a view of the existence of God. And we know in Hinduism, the God, the deity there, is scattered millions of it. Like I said, anything you can think about has got a God attached to it. Of course, Brahman is the superior God, okay? And there's three issues underneath him. Lord Shiva, Brahma, and Vishnu. But they had to deal with that force. Now, Hindus are interesting because Hindus don't really deal with the existence of God. They kind of sort of reference it, but their whole focus is on the self, on the individual, attitudes. Attitudes that keep them on the right path. And therefore, if they stay on the right path, see, they get better karma. See, and then they can, then they get inspired, okay? And they can transcend to a higher level, hopefully. So it's a little different idea of God there. Not as idealistic or idols, okay, as you have in Hinduism. So there's a split there on that. Even though they're all in basically the same part of the world. You find Buddhism in India, but you really find it down in the Southeast area. You know, Vietnam, Cambodia, all that area. And you also find Japan. And so it's areas that you grow up in, so that's what you do. And the festivals make things attractive. They certainly do. We're going to look at tonight, they have a different morality. And now I'm going to deal with that, the eightfold path, which you have in your material, the fourfold path, and the fulfill of that with deities. And even the view of Buddha, you know, see, they're over there, well, let me say this. Hinduism, I'll get to Buddha, the first Buddha, but Hinduism is what that man practiced. That man practiced. And he had the gods, but he went into a real strict asceticism, which is really a torture of the body, extreme selfness. And whether the things he ate, the way he lived, that sort of thing, I'll get to that. Now, so a different view of Buddha, where they think Buddha was this man who was a good teacher, not God, not deity, but a good teacher. And he put these eightfold, the noble four. And then when you get to Hinduism, they recognize Buddha, but they really say he was an avatar of one of the gods of Brahman. And I think we've seen the movie Avatar, all right? And matter of fact, in Hinduism, Jesus is viewed as an avatar. Okay? All right. Now, so just a little comparison there. Now, it's interesting to, I mentioned a while ago about when you see the timelines on when these different world faiths came to fruition, when they started, how they developed, the things that are involved in their development, the things they express in their quote-unquote holy books. You see a relationship of time, what's going on in the world at that time. And it's interesting, Hinduism, you know, we saw was around 1500 B.C. And then they didn't get the writing until about 1000 B.C., 1500, 1000 B.C. But Buddha was started in 600 B.C., see, after Hinduism, been around for quite a while in that part of the world. And then it was started to be written around 200 B.C. So you can see how Buddhism followed Hinduism. Okay. As a matter of fact, the first Buddha, an individual, was Hindu. He practiced Hinduism. And he was a rich guy from a rich family. And he wanted more out of life than just indulgences in this life. So he went off and became poor, lived poorly. He tortured his body. He did meditation all the time. And he finally came to the realization that, you know, this asceticism thing is just too much. It's too hard on me. But I don't want to live like I lived before I started getting religious and full indulging everything. You know, rich kid had everything. So he took the middle ground, quote unquote. The middle ground. And that middle ground is where he went away from that strict asceticism and strict indulgence. So that's what he taught. See, you see some advantage to that, people who have been in those religions? Yeah, I like something softer, something with less strain on the body. I've got things to do in life, and I just can't pray all the time. So I became a teacher of that. And as time progressed, he wrote things down. He had followers. He didn't follow Muhammad's method in Islam of killing people and going to war. He just talked. And he wrote some things down. Now, and all this dealt with enlightenment. How can we get my mind enlightened? How can I leave the suffering? So that's what he saw in the earth, when he saw asceticism especially. He came out of that suffering and said, this thing's got to be better than this. I've got to elevate my mind. We've got to deal with a higher plane. So suffering was his real motivating factor. And how can he help others to relieve suffering. Now, you may think suffering is a, what can I say, physical pain? Yeah. But he dealt with other kinds of suffering, anxieties, those things that, you know, may keep us awake all night sometimes. You don't have physical problem. But you've got things that you worry about. You've got things that other people say about you. You've got things that you want to do but you didn't get done. Of course, I'm just on the surface here. But all those emotions, so you want to deal with that. And once you get to that and you train your mind, then you can deal with nirvana and doing the right things and overlook things and bypass things that really affect you and cause suffering and pain and anguish and anxieties. So you really have calmness of spirit. And so that's why you see yoga classes. See things like that to calm the spirit. Now, but in that time that he's came out of that, let's write some things. And a Triataka, the holy book of Buddhism. And that didn't really get written down till 400 years after he died. So a lot of this stuff floats around like it's not oral. Okay, oral continuation, one monk to another. And so they wrote those out and down, and there was three of those. And there were three patikas. It's really called the triple basket. The triple basket. That's how you interpret that. And the basket is filled with certain things. And the first basket is called a vinaya. It's the conduct of the order of the teachers. How are they ordered? How do they study? What things do they look at? What commitments do they have to their teaching? And the second one was the sutta patika. And this is really all the Buddha sermons. He had a lot of sermons. And so you're really teaching from this first man. And he was his name. Okay? I'll say it in a minute. But he had just a man. Just a man. Never claimed deity. Some, what can I say, denominations, sects of Buddhism try to deify him. Okay? But he never wanted that. And generally in the mass today, he's not deified. Okay? Even though they put statues up and that sort of thing. And so that was the largest book of Buddha sermons. And number three was a Abhidhammapada. And it really dealt with, some people say, metaphysics. And really it's the psychology of Buddhists. And then eventually as time went on, the different councils, the Buddha councils, would add to the book and that sort of thing. So that's really the key books, the creed books they have. So all religions have those books. And also they got commentaries. And I was reading, they got commentaries on the commentaries. And we saw that in the other books that we have. And again, I mentioned that too in your Holy Bible. You got commentaries. And commentaries are, you have to be careful with those. It kind of depends who's putting them together. Yes, sir?
Different forms of Buddhism too.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yes. Yes, yes. Yeah. Like I said, I'll use the word denominations, okay? But yes. As in anything, people want to do their thing with the original, go off in a different course. And that's why you have developed such an area over there. Now, it kind of tracks the languages too, somewhat. All right? And so there's different Buddhism, okay? But basically, they all stay with these three, the trifecta. Now, of these three, you got the Vinayapika, which is a conduct and order, and that grew out of their rules. I saw that, and then also the Vinaya was focused on rules and regulations. And you got to have what do we do? How do we act this religion? How do we conduct ourselves? What do the priests do? What do the monks do? How do you do this? So they had that rule now. That was the second book. And within that second book, they had Buddha's five methods of how to think. Again, a lot of this is thinking religions here when you get to these points. And there's five of those. And the first one was you focus on an opposite or incompatible thought or object. So when you're doing your meditation, you tend to, what do you focus your mind on? What do you focus your mind on? Well, loud music? No. You focus it on opposite or incompatible thought or objects. Second was to ponder on the perils and disadvantages of the thought, its harmful consequences. Third, you ignore the thought and distract yourself from it through some other activity. If you can't deal with the thought or what's going on, you distract yourself. So these are basic comments that he put together. And to reflect on the removal or stopping of the causes of the target thought. So you're focused. You try to stay focused on one item and deal with it, whether dismiss it, substitute it, or dwell on it. And then you make, at the last, you make a forceful mental effort to deal with it. So, oh, this is psychology, right? Okay. And that's really what Buddhism is. A lot of psychology. A lot of dealing with the mind. We deal with attitudes about Christ, don't we? Attitudes about our worship. Attitudes about family. And that's what he dealt with. Okay. And again, all this is to get your mind away from suffering. Okay. Those things that would divert your mind and put you in another realm. All right. And again, when you get your mind focused, then you're doing things that are acceptable and your karma's good. And then that's the name of the game. Get your karma up. So one day you're going to get old and die, and you want to come back at a higher level, or you want to come back. You don't want to come back at a lower level, because then you got to start all over. And then finally you can reach nirvana after that. Now, and they've got a word called mindfulness. In developing mindfulness, one is advised to be aware of all thoughts and sensations that arise, even unwanted or unpleasant ones, and continuously attend to such thoughts. You got those thoughts, you attend them, you stay with them. Eventually, through effort and exposure, the intensity and unpleasantness of such thoughts will disappear. So you really think something to be gone, or is it that important? And we can do that, okay? We can do that, but to focus your entire effort on that. And again, with the goal not to be pleasing to one God, Jehovah God, but to be pleasing so that you can be reincarnated or not be reincarnated to the next level. All right. And let's see, I'll just skip those. Now, the Buddha, who was just a man, again, never claimed deity, he developed a way to think. And in your material, you've got four noble truths, which was the basis of it. And these are fundamental to all Buddhisms. Okay, Alex? All of them are fundamental to it. And again, they deal with the mind. And these four noble truths is really a framework for how you do the rest of your thinking, how you put things in action. And first noble truth was a concept, again, it's a dukkha, are ideas such as anxiety, frustration, and dissatisfaction. This is the core belief of Buddhism, and all other beliefs of Christ are based on the first noble truth, that there's anxiety and frustration out there, the dissatisfaction. Okay, those things that disrupt our thought and our lives, that keep us off of the track that we want to be on. And so suffering is part of that, and that's wrong for mankind to have those kind of thoughts. And suffering caused by having the wrong desires, specific desires, things that are only temporary. Okay, so we have some thoughts, got problems in our lives, and that's the second noble truth is, it's only temporary. Those things you're talking about, anxiety, those things get you upset, that divert you off your path. Just temporary. You got to get that in your mind. And that's the second path, and it deals with craving, all these desires. Okay? So all that leads to suffering, and even positive desires have a cause and effect, don't they? They have a cause and effect. And keep your mind occupied. Now, the third noble truth, so if you've got suffering, okay, it's here. and you know it's temporary, yes, so what do you do? Let's get rid of it. Let's liberate it. Try to move it on. And that's the third mobile truth, is free from this cycle of suffering, death, and rebirth. That's how you deal with nirvana. Move on from that. Get your mind right. Think things that are pleasing to Buddha, that he's taught you. And you eliminate those desires that are temporal. Keith, you're thinking about maybe work tomorrow. Maybe you got some heavy deadlines to make. But that's a temporary. And you get anxieties with that, especially when it's not going right. All right? Or equipment breaks down. What's a thought out there that gives you peace beyond this?
God,
heaven. Family. Yeah. Life after. Life after. Motivation, doesn't it? Puts things in perspective. So that's kind of what they're doing here. Yours thinking about heaven. See? Beyond this life. Well, they just want to calm the nerves and make nirvana. Hopefully they get reincarnated or they say they reach their potential. So it's things that we can think about. Now, good Keith, good Keith. All right? And the fourth noble is, guess what the fourth noble truth is? Look at the eightfold. Oh, I got some more rules for you. All right? So you want to get your mind right, then you go to the eight noble truth. Is it already on? Okay. All right. So be sure to look at that eight noble truth for next time. We'll go through that. And we'll get into folk religions. Interesting to investigate that. Thank you very much.